Our next case this morning is Nicollet Plaza LLC versus Chase Real Estate Inc. et al. So as you're getting settled, as I'm sure appellant, it's counsel and respondents, counsel know, appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondents will have 15 minutes in total. I guess my first question is, we have a few respondents. If you could tell me who you're representing, and then if you're splitting your time, how much is getting, or who is getting how much, and who's going first?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is David Davenport, and I represent Chase Real Estate.
Yes, and I'm John Baker, Green Escrow, representing the City of Burnsville.
I'm Eric Dwyer, representing KSH Development.
And are you, Mr. Davenport, will you be splitting your time, and how much?
We would like to, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Principally, what we've agreed to do is I would take half the time, and my colleague to my left would take the other half. I don't think I'll need a full half.
Okay.
Just give him the remainder of it.
So, Mr. Baker, you'll be getting 7.5 minutes. Mr. Davenport, 7.5 minutes, or how much he uses. And then, as my understanding, Mr. Dwyer, you will not be arguing?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. I appreciate your clarifying that. In that case, counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, you can approach the microphone. The podium goes up and down now. Please adjust the microphone to your level and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Christopher Penwell on behalf of the appellant, Nicollet Plaza, LLC. I'd like to jump right in and focus on the three main documents that govern what can be built on Lot 3 in the Nicollet Plaza Center. First is the Declaration of Reciprocal Rights and Easements, under which Opus at the time and appellant as the successor to Opus reserved for its for itself the right to withhold approval of the plans for Lot 3 as long and must cannot unreasonably withhold approval as long as the plans are substantially in accordance with the 2004 plans.
And it's that document, Mr. Penwell, that led to the litigation. In other words, if I understand the facts correctly, it was a request for your client to give that approval pursuant to that document?
Correct, yes.
And so that's how then your client brings the declaratory judgment request to say, in fact, it is reasonable for all the reasons, of course, that you are about to get into.
That is a significant piece of this lawsuit, yes.
How significant is that versus the PUD? Is that the acronym, PUD, which your client and at least predecessors of everyone's, some of the clients signed? How significant is that versus the declaration, in your opinion, in terms of this court's review of the trial court's decision?
Well, they formed the basis for different claims in the lawsuit, and so I don't know that I want to tell the court that we prefer one over the other. We think that each
you went
one
under all of them, right?
I'm sorry?
I imagine you say you went under all of them.
I certainly do say that, yes. So I hope that answers Your Honor's question.
To get to the heart of the matter, it looks like what's alleged as substantial changes involve, parking seems to be a big part of the issue, and then the fact that apartments instead of condominium are to be built, for which you are asked, your client's asked to give consent. Do both documents reference the original plan and,
yes,
and reference both condominiums as well as apartments and give some designation of how many parking spots and those sorts of issues? And that's what I was really getting at the heart of my question. So both documents are relevant for both of those issues, and they have different terms that the parties have argued about, but both documents.
And there's actually a third document that I also want to focus on, which is the purchase agreement between Opus and KSH, under which Lot 3 was sold by Opus to KSH. So I've talked about the declaration that says approval won't be unreasonably withheld as long as the plans are substantially in accordance with the 2004 plans. Then there's the Opus-KSH purchase agreement, which says in Section 4A that KSH shall construct the improvements. The improvements is a defined term that's found in a TIF agreement between KSH and the city that says at least 132 owner-occupied units and 8,000 square feet of retail. And Section 4A of the Opus-KSH purchase agreement says KSH shall construct the improvements in accordance with the 2004 plans, and that if there's any material changes to those plans, it must be approved by, at the time, Opus, and now, again, appellant as the successor and assignee of Opus rights under the under that purchase agreement. And then finally, there's the development contract, or the PUD agreement, I think it's variously called. Section 8 says that the Lot 3 shall be developed in accordance with the 2004 plans, and Section 9 says the city shall approve those the plans that are submitted by KSH if they do not deviate in any material respect from the 2004 plans. So a couple of points about that. In all three documents, it's more or less the same standard, whether you're talking about substantially in accordance with the 2004 plans, or there won't be any material deviation from the 2004 plans, or there won't be any material changes to the 2004 plans. It's, I would say, essentially the same standard. And
Mr. Penwell, on that point, getting to Judge Sleater's point, you know, on the parking, you go to great lengths to say, well, you know, the dimensions are different. Therefore, it's not substantially the same. But even though, and we get in debate into, you know, the parking spaces. But you know, if the dimensions aren't if the dimensions of these parking spaces aren't defined anywhere or mentioned anywhere, how would we interpret that to be a material difference between the two plans if they're not even discussed?
I'm sorry, if the dimensions...
If the... maybe I have this wrong. But it's my understanding that the agreement doesn't specifically discuss the dimensions of the parking spaces. Am I correct about that?
If you're referring to the 2004 plans, I know that that's one point that the respondents have made, that we don't know what the dimensions
yes.
are in the 2004
right.
plans.
The district court as well.
Thank you, Judge Halbert.
Okay.
So, I mean, am I correct that the 2004 plans do not specify parking stall dimensions nor specify whether parking complies with industry standards? Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement.
Okay. So, you know, if that's the case, and... how would we sort of focus on dimensions as being something that's not substantially in accordance with? You know, why would we want to focus on that if it wasn't even so important to be defined? It's my understanding that a good portion of the argument is, well, you know, you can't just look at the spaces; you got to look at how big they are, and I certainly agree with that. But if it's not defined, why would we so easily reverse the district court on the grounds that it erred in determining whether or not the two plans were substantially in accordance?
Well, the dimensions are only one issue. What's problematic about the district court's decision is that the district court completely ignored the three appellant's experts who provided opinions. Dimensions were certainly one piece of it, but that wasn't the only basis on which appellant's experts found that the 265 parking spaces shown on Chase's plans could not actually be built. And beyond simply that, Dr. Thomas Mussel, said that because of density issues, because of parking issues, that the value of appellant's property is going to decrease over time, and that's an unrebutted opinion. So all three experts are unrebutted.
Is there going to be parking more on your lot rather than their?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, yes. That's what I assumed.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. And
you have the Cub. So the last thing you want is people. The last thing you want are Cub customers not being able to park in the Cub parking
lot. Sure,
and they're not going to
yes,
shop at Cub.
Yes, exactly. And we also make the point that the appellant has the right to use the parking lot to, for example, build a freestanding restaurant. And obviously, if the appellant were to do that, restaurant generates a tremendous amount of traffic. And so, you know, respondents love to talk about.
One thing I learned at Krause Anderson is parking is everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did your expert, just to clarify that point, did the expert opine, though, and this gets to the heart of, I think, some of the judges and my colleagues' questions, what the old floor plan and what was identified there versus the 2017? Because is that not the genuine issue, perhaps, whether there are facts in dispute, but that's the legal issue as to whether consent is improvidently withheld, in other words. And so we're comparing those, right?
Well, you know, in 2004, everybody was on the same page as shown in these documents. So you have Opus, you have KSH, you have the city, and they're all on the same page about, you know, they put these plans together. That's what's in the development contract, is an actual list of plans. And so we don't have any doubt about whether all the parties to that original development contract were on the same page in terms of, will this work? What impact will one lot what we do on one lot have on another lot. So it's really, I don't think it's fair to say that the expert had to talk about, well, what's the impact of the 2004 plans, you know, on what's being proposed on lot three, what impact will that have on the shopping center? Because we know that everybody was in agreement about those plans because it's in a contract.
For this, for the judge's decision, though, was it not at importance? For instance, I assume the expert, if the parties all agree it was a bad plan then, it's a bad plan now, but that would still not withstand summary judgment, I'm presuming, because there was no substantial change. They're both bad, if you follow my question. So
I do, except that we have to assume everybody thought the 2004 was a good plan, that it would work, that everybody would benefit from what was proposed in the 2004 plan. So that's the baseline. It's clear in all the documents, the 2004 plans are the baseline against which we compare what Chase is proposing to put on lot three now. And so the issue is there, you know, is it substantially in accordance? Is there a material change? And my point is we've got three experts that say you can't just assume that the 265 parking spaces that are shown on the plans can actually be built. Here's reasons why they can't. And so they talk about about parking, they talk about density, and then Dr. Mussel. And I should point out the district court said that the claim by appellant that what is proposed on lot three by Chase will devalue appellant's property is unsubstantiated. That's what Dr. Mussel's report is about, and I invite you to look at that report. Look at his curriculum vitae. He is a very impressive expert in this field. That doesn't mean he's right, but the fact that we've got three experts submitted by appellants and none by respondents, only they're sort of, you know, I don't know if it's fair to say they're back of the napkin calculation, is not enough to overcome these three experts. You know, I think the fact that those are unrebutted would be enough to rule in appellant's favor as opposed to reverse and remanding. But at a minimum, the case law is clear that questions of whether consent has been reasonably or unreasonably withheld is a fact question. And based on what you have before you, three unrebutted experts that are saying that, you know, this is a material change, this is going to devalue appellant's property, at a minimum, again, creates a fact question that the district court simply ignored.
But doesn't it sounds, you know, from your description of the expert, and I've not read that specific report, that it was a broader examination of the issues, whereas the district court here, based on the agreements, was looking at this narrow question, comparing the 04 terms with what, you know, is now being proposed for Lot 3 and making this judgment as to whether or not you know, the way they are compared, whether consent being withheld is reasonable. I mean, so it seemed like a narrower framework than perhaps the experts addressed.
Well, the way I would characterize it, as I read the district court's decision, the only thing that the district court did was compare pieces of paper, 2004 plans and what's shown on those plans with Chase's plans and what's actually shown on those plans without any consideration being given to whether what Chase has proposed could actually be built. And so I think that maybe you're right that the consideration was narrower, but it's appellant's position that it was far too narrow, that it excluded reality by simply comparing pieces of paper and saying, well, is there a substantial change between, you know, the footprint's the same and, you know, apartments versus condos isn't that big of a deal. But the main thing is that the district court comes to the conclusion or agrees with the respondent's conclusion that both plans show basically 1.2 bedrooms per parking space. And that's an incorrect conclusion based on the appellant's experts. And so to simply say we can put aside what the appellant's experts opined and just compare the pieces of paper and see if they're the same is not the correct analysis. I hope that answered your honors.
You. Mr. Penwell, did your experts then address also separately or opine, or is there genuine issues you believe a material fact related to whether the change from apartment or from condominium to apartment also was a substantial change from 04 to 17?
Yes, that is our position. You know, one of the reasons it's based on that is that the Opus KSH agreement that says KSH shall construct the improvements. That's a defined term. That term is found in the TIF agreement, and it says 132 owner-occupied units and 8,000 square feet of retail. Now, the respondents have said that the definition of improvements changed in the TIF agreement, which is an agreement that Opus and appellant they're not a party to that agreement, but they borrowed the definition of improvements from that agreement, and respondents are trying to claim that as KSH and the city changed that definition, that therefore changed the definition in the KSH Opus purchase agreement, and we simply disagree with that. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Penwell. You will have rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for Chase Real Estate, Mr. Davenport.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is David Davenport with the law firm of Winthrop and Weinstein, and I'd like to jump right in and answer a couple of the salient questions that I heard, specifically with respect to a couple of questions relevant to the experts. And the questions were, did the experts that the appellant offered at the district court compare the 2004 plans to the Chase's plans and opine that they are not substantially in accord with one another? The very short, simple answer is no, they did not. You have three expert reports from the appellants, a Kukli, a Niedecker, and a Musil. The Musil report is what my colleague focused on today, and he does not opine that the plans are not substantially in accord. He has at page 22 of his reports findings and conclusions, none of which state, it is my opinion that the plans are not in substantial accord with one another. So all the discussion about experts essentially does what Your Honor suggest that is painting with a broad brush and overlooking the fact that this is a very narrow inquiry by the very nature of the plain and unambiguous language used in the declaration. And the declaration defines and limits the scope of their ability to withhold consent. And it specifically was negotiated by the parties back then that, sure, you can withhold consent, but only if the plans that we're going to build today are not in substantial accord with the plans that were of record in 2004 when that agreement was reached.
Is it possible that you could make an inference from the report that despite the experts' failure to address the direct question?
I think it would be a very large stretch and improper inference to make because the witness has to disclose, I reviewed the 2004 reports and I studied them and I compared them, and he doesn't do that, right? So it's very difficult in my mind as a trial lawyer to say, well, we can make an inference from something that's in an expert report when the rules of civil procedure expressly state and require full disclosure of all opinions and the bases therefore, and we don't get the opportunity to depose an expert because those are the rules, and that's fine. But we can't then come in and be subject to inferences that aren't there because we're hamstrung as trial lawyers. So with respect to the experts, they didn't look at the narrow question. And the narrow question is, as we have discussed, and exactly what the district court did. The district court said, hey, okay, what are their bases for withholding their approval, not consenting to the Chase 2017 plans? There was a lot of discussion about parking. Your Honor is correct that the 2004 plans don't discuss anything about parking dimensions. The 2004 plans also don't discuss apartments versus condominiums. They talk about mixed-use residential building, which is exactly what the Chase plans are, a mixed-use residential building, as the district court properly concluded. As it relates to bedrooms, the district court did a really nice job of evaluating the evidence before it, not the broad brush arguments that really didn't have supportive evidence in the record, and talked about the 1.2 ratio of parking to bedrooms. 213 bedrooms in a 167 residential unit building proposed by Chase, 192 bedrooms in a 131 residential unit proposed by, the 2004 plans. So then you start looking at parking. And the district court properly concluded that the parking spaces in the Chase plans depict and provide for 16 more parking spots than the 2004 plans provide. And it's important to note that while I can appreciate concerns about value depreciations, we certainly don't agree with that, but it's immaterial because the parties agreed back in 2004 when the declaration was entered into that the relevant inquiry would be, are the plans substantially in accord? If it turns out that they are, which they are here, and they want to claim through experts that, well, it's going to depreciate my value, we disagree with that, but it's irrelevant.
Mr. Dyer, can I, so if the judge said that 16 more, and I recall seeing that as well, then there obviously there was a baseline from the earlier plans from which the parties must have agreed, and I don't know if it was 240 some or some number like that.
Correct, pretty close. It was 249 spaces depicted in the 2004 plans, 165 of which were garage, and I apologize, I can never say that word right, and 84 surface lots. The Chase plans provide for 265 spaces, 196 garage, 69 surface. More parking than was provided for in the 2004 plans, and we ought not forget there's a shared parking agreement in place that allows for, if we need it, additional parking, because that's the heart of the city development.
My question then is, that being the case, is it does the appellant's expert agree there's 16 more parking spots under the new plan?
I think the appellant's expert disagrees with the number of stalls in the sense that they make these contentions that, well, they're measured wrong, or you can't do it because of accessibility code or some other things like that.
Some were tandem, some were...
Correct.
Yeah. My question then, would that not, however, then, and that's appellant's position, create a fact issue of with live testimony so the judge can hear, well, what's this tandem mean and why are you saying there aren't spots, and to get to then come to a conclusion of whether there's more, whether there's less, and even if there is less under either scenario, is it substantial?
Not in the record before the district court, because they don't actually have an expert that then takes those assumptions and opinions and applies them to the standard and says, in my opinion, it's not substantially in accord. Maybe if you evaluate Dr. Musil's report, you can find some inference in there that his reconfiguring of things results in 230 spaces. That would still, in my view, be in substantial accord with the plans, in part because we have the shared parking lot that everybody uses and is nearly vacant, as supported in the record, most of the time. So, you know, I think perhaps you could hypothesize in some regard that way, but what we have before us is a record and facts that were before the court and a finding of fact by the court that they didn't submit the evidence that they needed to satisfy their burden to show that they were reasonably withholding consent. And in that regard, I would just like to highlight that the standard of review here, as set forth in our papers, and I don't believe as challenged by appellant, when you're dealing with a declaratory judgment claim like we have here in count one asserted against Chase relative to this declaration, the court applies a clearly erroneous standard of review to the findings of fact, and then reviews the district court's determination of legal conclusions de novo. So relative to what the district court concluded as to the evidence before him and the facts he relied upon to make his findings, it's clearly erroneous. They can't show that. Well, I guess I ended up using my 7 minutes, so I'll step aside unless you had any more questions.
No, thank you very much, Mr. Davenport. We'll now hear from counsel for the City of Burnsville, Mr. Baker.
Good morning, Your Honors, again. This morning, I plan to address the plaintiff's two primary claims against the city, and unless the court has any questions for me with regard to other topics, I'll rest on the briefs with regard to those other topics. I'll first address the plaintiff's claim that the city breached the 2004 PUD agreement by failing to get plaintiff's consent before amending the PUD in 2017. Then I plan to address plaintiff's claim that, in essence, no city in Minnesota has the authority to amend or, by implication, even to adopt a planned unit development by ordinance. Now, an essential premise of plaintiff's contract claim is that the city gave both KSH and the plaintiff's seller, Opus, veto power over the city's ability to approve any PUD amendments. That's solely based upon something in the miscellaneous section of the 2004 PUD agreement that includes this sentence: to be binding, amendments or waivers shall be in writing, signed by the parties, and approved by written resolution of the council. At this point, plaintiff has made it easier for the court to decide this claim based upon what it hasn't said in its briefs. The city briefed three independent reasons for affirmance on this issue, but the plaintiff has only addressed the second and the third and ignored the lead one in their briefs. Our lead argument on this claim was that plaintiff's assertion that the city had a duty to obtain consent depends on words that aren't actually in the sentence that they're relying upon. The sentence says signed by the parties, but it doesn't say signed by the parties to the 2004 PUD agreement. The phrase "of this agreement" isn't in the sentence at all, but the word "amendment" is in the sentence. In fact, amendment is one of the two subjects of that sentence. There is a canon of construction that applies in this setting. I won't try to give to fumble on the...
Mr. On this very point, Mr. Baker, I had a more practical question. So on these amendments where... it seemed like some of them were signed by appellants, some of them were signed by the respondents. I guess my question relates to the amendments that were not signed by one party or the other, but presumably were always signed by your client. Do those amendments that were signed, do they relate to the specific parcel that the parties owned? So, for example, if yes. There was an amendment to Lot 3 that obviously directly affects, the respondents because they own Lot 3, I assume that was signed by the owner of Lot 3, but yes. Not the owners of the other lots.
Yes. For example, the amendment that added two additional drive-through lanes for the Office Bank building was signed by the city and by the owner of that, but not KSH.
Were there any amendments, and I assume also on the other side, if there were amendments that were only relating to the parcels that the appellants owned, that those amendments were never signed by the owner of Lot 3?
That was always the case, Your Honor.
Were there any amendments to this agreement that were signed by all parties?
No.
Okay.
And if the court resolves it based upon the construction, canon of construction, it doesn't even need to reach the question that they've raised, which is whether or not there's a fact issue on that. But to get to that point, one of the reasons there's not a fact question is that what was true is true 100% of the time. So this isn't one of these situations in which they cite one course of conduct, we cite another course of conduct. No, the course of conduct is entirely consistent with our interpretation and entirely inconsistent with their interpretation. But that's our second argument.
Mr. Baker, just to clarify, though, the parties, there's no dispute, though, that the parties, there are three, of which, again, two of which are successor, but we'll just for today's purposes, that includes appellant here. So there's no dispute that by the plain language, the parties, there was three of them.
Not for purposes of the sentence that they are relying upon for saying that their consent is necessary.
Because does it define it other than, are you referring to the course of conduct or the language of the sentence? Does it have any language in there that differentiates the parties when it comes to amendment?
It does, based upon the appropriate canon of construction, because the word amendments is in that sentence, and the phrase of this agreement isn't in that sentence, then under the canon that the words are interpreted according to their associates.
Do we get, but what I'm getting at then, your position is that that's an ambiguous statement, so we need to go to canons of construction to interpret that sentence.
Yes, and the arguments are entirely from our side. There has been no argument provided to the contrary in the briefs, and so for that reason, they have provided this court with a particularly safe basis for affirming the district court on that. But
I have then, in 2017, the reason there needed to be an amendment, needed to be an amendment to the PUD is the change from condominiums to apartments. And the point being is I saw at least two sentences, owner-occupied, or at least two provisions of the three documents, and I don't remember which because I have them confused, the phrase owner-occupied. And so the 2017 made clear that it would be an apartment.
I'm glad you asked, Your Honor, so I can clarify. That distinction appears nowhere in the PUD agreement. That distinction does not even appear in the plans that they are purporting to enforce under Section 8. That is something that comes from extraneous agreements, and there's certainly not a basis here for them to rely upon that in any respect to say that. In fact, they said in front of the city council, we don't care about the apartments. So for them to now sort of try and build a theory upon that is disingenuous. But yet there's even a third problem they've got with a contract argument, and that's based upon City of Lugar versus City of Burnsville. No city can give a neighboring property owner the power to prevent this, prevent the city from giving approval to an amendment. If I can shift with what's left to the PUDs by ordinance are illegal. They are asking the court to be the first one ever to say that PUDs by ordinance lack authority based on no applicable case law. We rely upon 462.357 subdivision 1. None of the cases that they cite in support of their argument interpret 462.357 subdivision 1. And their argument isn't, well, there's some limiting language in there. Instead, their argument is, well, gosh, if that's your authority, it's broad. It's too broad, and therefore, if it's too broad, it should be ignored in the first place. There's no case that supports that. And their notion that because after it was clear from the Supreme Court decisions in Zilka and in Chandler that municipalities have this authority, a change 12 or 15 or so years later somehow implicitly took that away by permitting cities to also do this by CUP is disingenuous. I see my lights on. We would urge the court to affirm the district court's judgment in full.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Mr. Penwell, you'll have the last word, sir.
I'm going to start with a point that Mr. Davenport made, which that appellant's experts did not opine on the ultimate issue in this matter, which is, in fact, the fact question that will go to the jury. It is true that the experts didn't say, jury, you should find that the plans are not the Chase's plans are not substantially in accordance with the 2004 plans. What those experts did is say, let me start with this, because it's very important that we start with the baseline that the parties agreed in 2004, here's what we're going to build. There's a set of plans that's specifically identified in the development agreement. All three parties are signatories to the development contract, and they've said this is what we're going to build. And it says you have to build that unless you can show that an alternate plan is not substantial in accordance or doesn't have a material change or whatever. So appellant's experts showed that there is a 20% difference in the bedroom per parking space ratio in the Chase plans versus the 2004 plans. And Dr. Mussel said that because of the lack of parking and the increased density, the lack of parking that's going to devalue appellant's property. So if the jury believes appellant's experts, I don't think they can come to any other conclusion but that Chase's plans are not substantially in accordance with the 2004 plans. So it is absolutely not necessary that plaintiff's experts opine on that fact issue, and nor do I think that would be appropriate. I don't even think the judge would say the experts get to tell the jury what they should determine about this fact question. Secondly, I'm gonna go to Mr. Baker's last point because I don't want it to be lost that the issue or appellant's position that the city did not have statutory authority to do what they did and give the approval on that property, that issue is equally as important to us, and we feel very strongly that issue that we are correct on this issue. And I do want to just point out that 460 Minstat section 462.3595 subdivision 1 is the only contains the only statutory reference to planned unit developments, and says the government body may by ordinance designate certain types of developments, including planned unit developments and certain land development activities, as conditional uses under zoning regulations. So the statute that the city relies on is simply gives cities authority to pass a zoning ordinance. In this case, Title 10 is the city of Burnsville's zoning ordinance that splits the city up into, I think, 25 different zoning districts.
Mr. Penwell, getting back to a point before your time runs out,
sure.
Do you disagree with the point that the original documents do not identify owner-occupied? In other words, if I understood that correctly, there's absolutely no change going from a condo to an apartment.
Well, what Mr. Baker referred to as an extraneous document is a very important document to us, and that is the purchase agreement between Opus and KSH that uses the definition of improvements is owner-occupied units and not apartments. And so that is a very important point to us because Opus reserved the right in that purchase agreement to approve or disapprove plans that differed from the 2004 plans if they weren't, I think it was, if there was any material deviation. And so our position is that going from owner-occupied to apartment is a material deviation from the 2004 plans.
Thank you.
But I do agree that owner-occupied is not in the development contract, other than I think there's one reference that there has to be one underground parking space for each condominium or owner-occupied unit. I can't remember, but that's the only reference I'm aware of in the development contract. I guess the last point I'll make on the amendments issue, section 33G of the development contract, is that you don't look at other amendments unless the language of section 33G is ambiguous, and our position is that parties means parties, and it means all three parties. Thank you.
But you would agree, before you sit down,
yes,
that of these seven amendments, none were signed by all parties.
Can I give you just a little bit more than a yes or no on that?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Because the answers the answer is
yes, but
yes, but the answer is yes, but none of those amendments. I go back to section 8 and 9 of the development contract. Section 8 says we're going to build these plants, these specifically identified plans, and section 9 says the city will approve the plans that are submitted for lot 3. Unless there's a material change from the plans that are, and that's the fundamental basis of the agreement between the three parties. None of those other amendments went to that fundamental basis. It's signage, it's trash enclosures, it's drive-through lanes that are specific to each piece of property, which has no bearing on an amendment that goes to the fundamental basis that the parties agreed on when they entered into this contract. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Council. This being our last oral argument of the day, we are now adjourned.